For Joe Public Media, I'm Tom Jackson, and today I'm going to be talking with Kathy Kelly, three-time Nobel Peace Prize nominee for her work in Iraq during the era of the economic sanctions, co-founder of Voices in the Wilderness, and now co-founder of an organization called Voices for Creative Nonviolence. And we'll be talking to her for about the next 45 minutes or so. Kathy, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. It's very good to be with you.
Well, tell us, for people who may need a little bit of an update, for all practical purposes, I guess that Voices in the Wilderness is officially not an organization anymore, and maybe you can give people an update on what's happened in the last year or so as far as Voices in the Wilderness goes.
Well, Voices had campaigned from 1996 onward to end the economic sanctions against Iraq, and did much of that work through organizing delegations that would travel to Iraq and break the economic sanctions. And certainly we were on the radar of the United States government. The Office of Foreign Assets Control under the Treasury Department had given us a stiff warning as soon as we started the campaign, and there was quite a lot of correspondence and imposition of pre-penalty notices. As soon as we announced that we would remain in Iraq throughout the Shock and Awe campaign and started formation of an Iraq peace team, we got a word from the Treasury Department that we must now go to Washington, D.C. and explain before a judge why we hadn't paid a fine that was imposed on us. And so that was the final round of courtroom hearings, and we did lose that case. The judge, in a 19-page opinion, wrote on the final page that those who break an unjust law should do so openly, lovingly, and with a willingness to pay the penalty. And we tried to clarify to the judge that if he wanted to put us in jail, we'd go openly and lovingly, but we won't turn over one dime, Tom, not one dime, to the war criminals that are prolonging this warfare against Iraq even as we speak right now. So we've made it clear to all the people that were supporters and participants in that campaign, Voices in the Wilderness, that we won't walk away from the work, and we hope that they won't either. Actually, although the economic sanctions have been lifted, an economic warfare continues against Iraq along with the military warfare, and people in Iraq are just plain trapped. You can't walk away from their concerns and from the possibility that maybe hearts in the United States would be so touched that people would say, well, we ought to pay reparation for the suffering caused, and we ought to stop manufacturing and sending bullets and bombs and airplanes that are loaded up with weapons and soldiers who often are, you know, our young people so needed here at home or to do humanitarian relief elsewhere, and instead are trained in a reactionary way to say the word kill 3,000 times a day and to be very frightened, as well they should be, because of the scenario into which they're being sent. So there's plenty of work to be done. We're now Voices for Creative Nonviolence, wanting to create the further invention of nonviolence commensurate to the terrible, terrible warmongering that plagues our world today. And we know much of it is fueled by the decision of the U.S. public to allow $437 billion of their wealth and productivity to go into the hands of those who would make weapons and recommend war as the way to solve problems.
Well, Kathy, I know that you still have a number of contacts in Iraq from the days of Voices in the Wilderness. Give us a picture of day-to-day life, let's say, in Baghdad for most Iraqis, maybe the people that we don't hear so much about in our media from day-to-day here.
Well, right now, I hear from the Christian Peacemaker Team people that are in the Qarada district of Baghdad, and as I'm sure many of your listeners would know, they're full of grief and mourning because their colleague, Tom Fox, was killed after being kidnapped, and they know that there are sometimes 30 people a day, on average, kidnapped in Iraq today. So people are afraid often to go outside their houses. They want to make sure at the end of the night that everybody is inside locked doors. Right now, some people are stocking up their storage rooms because they're afraid there might be a month-long curfew as the cities become more violent by the day, and now they are suffering air attacks as well. There's a huge air attack that went on in an area just west of Samarra, 60 miles north of Baghdad. So some people are wondering, do we have to flee in case our neighborhood would become bombed or in case there might be house-to-house types of fighting? So there's a tremendous high anxiety. Now, factor in that in Baghdad, the amount of electricity on a good day is 4 hours per day. Some of our young people here are doing an electricity fast, a 34-day electricity fast, and I so admire them, willing to impose on themselves a month and 2 days of experience going without cell phones and computers and refrigeration and lamps and all of the many things that we take for granted. Well, can you imagine how an industrialized society is so frustrated when they are now on well over a decade of trying to cope with outages and shortages of something that we ourselves feel is so basic as electricity? And then there are the problems with not being able to get clean water, and contaminated water causes awful diseases. And you and I would remember that from Basra, when people are just brought down to their knees and feel totally sapped of energy. And for children, many of whom are suffering malnourishment, the United Nations Development Program reported in October 2004 that there were 300,000 children suffering from acute malnourishment. So you have parents desperate to try to get food and medicine, and this is a wearying and a terrible toll on families. The literacy rates are lower, far lower, really, than they were before Saddam's era, and actually lower than they were just before the invasion under shock and awe. And I think many people quite likely start to wonder, does any country or group in the world care about what's happening to people in Iraq, and what crime have they committed? What have they done?
Well, I remember some people in Iraq asking the question out loud to whoever was listening, you know, what have we done to cause the whole world to turn its back on us?
I mean, just today, there was a report about a farmhouse in Balad, and somebody had given information that there might be an insurgent living in this area. And so the United States attacked the farmhouse, and pictures are being shown on the Arab and the Iraqi media of at least 11 victims, one a grandmother, 65 years old, another a tiny infant, bodies wrapped in blankets, the house demolished. Well, you know, when people see those images in Iraq, I think they rightly feel indignant. They have a terrible grievance. They don't feel at all as though they're safe. But if we don't see the images here, and I think often we don't, then people just get the idea of kind of an annoyance. You know, why can't those Iraqis just stop fighting with each other? I sometimes, you know, Tom, every time you and I left Iraq, I know we felt as though we were being freed. We'd go back to a country where our comforts, our basic needs would be met without question. And it was like we were kind of leaving one big prison because people in Iraq were trapped. And, you know, if you use that prison analogy just a little bit further, suppose that there was a prison where there was an uprising, where there was a riot. And let's suppose that 95% of the people in the prison should never have been imprisoned in the first place. They'd done nothing wrong. And then you find out that the prisoners didn't have water, clean water, and they weren't getting adequate food, and they were under death threats, and they were being bombed steadily from above with 5,000-pound bombs falling inside the prison compound. And then suppose still further that the prisoners were extremely anxious because they had heard that cell blocks would be attacking other cell blocks. Well, you could imagine that anybody who had some kind of a sensible, rational approach wouldn't say, well, send in more air attacks and send in more military and punish these people further. You'd want to say, make sure these people start to get their most basic needs met. But instead, this bill that I think probably will pass in the House of Representatives today, an emergency supplemental bill, will designate $65 billion of U.S. wealth and productivity, $65 billion to go to Iraq, most of it for more military procurements, lining the pockets of companies that produce weapons or do logistical support. I'm thinking of Halliburton and Bechtel. and Kellogg, Brown & Root, Alion Tech, Boeing, General Electric, Westinghouse, those companies benefit from the war. The only item of new construction you can see in that whole $65 billion bill is the construction of 10,000 new prison beds inside Iraq.
Well, I want to turn for just a second to a place in Iraq that we perhaps hear even less about here in the United States than other parts of the country. We tend to hear about the areas, you know, not to say that we hear everything that we probably ought to, but we hear more about the areas in which U.S. troops are located. We hear just about nothing about the city of Basra, where you and I have spent some time. And I'm wondering what you might be hearing from some of the people that we know there or other contacts that you may have developed there. I mean, my concern is that there does seem to be a little bit of a tendency to think that things must be okay in Basra because we're not hearing anything about it.
Well, I think that the fear that pervades Iraq has certainly not escaped people in Basra. On the street, Tom, where we sometimes referred to it as Missile Street, on that street there's a man who was the father of two beautiful young daughters and a new infant son. We sometimes referred to him as Chinchin, and I'm sorry to say that he was killed 2 weeks ago by armed gunmen. I don't know more about that. Previously, a woman who was a very good friend of ours was traveling just outside of Basra on the outskirts with her husband and her daughter, and armed gunmen attacked that car, and the daughter was badly injured. Her jaw was cracked, her teeth were smashed, her tongue was torn in half, and so that family is trying to deal with the day-to-day care for a young girl who, when she went to get the first of several rounds of reconstructive surgery, had to endure that surgery with no anesthetics. Unimaginable. Doctors were frustrated because the x-ray machines are producing grainy images that they have a hard time analyzing. And the conditions in the hospital, and this is after they'd gone to Baghdad, were so slovenly that the family was afraid their beloved daughter would be infected, and so they actually, also frightened by the violence in Baghdad, went back to Basra. But there's a great deal of anxiety. People, I think, don't yet have job security. Some of the teachers have a lot more security, quite honestly, than they had before, and their salaries may have gone from $3 up to, you know, as high as $300 a month. But I think that the Southern Iraq Oil Company, located in Basra, is still not able to produce the levels of oil that would be greater than what were being produced by Iraq just prior to the shock and awe invasion. And that's basically Iraq's top crop, is the oil. They don't have a wide diversity of other things they can produce. And, of course, I mean, it might seem very odd to us here at this distance, but some of the things that have added to frustration in everyday life in Iraq include things that should have been under the province of the Ministry of Planning, of some sort of group that would have responsibility for trying to determine how many products from outside Iraq should come flowing in across the borders. And because there was no protection or awareness of what would be coming across the borders immediately after the United States began the occupation, Iraq was flooded with goods and products that other countries wanted to unload on the Iraqis, and there were things that Iraqis were very, very eager to buy up, things like toasters and space heaters and satellite dishes and televisions, but they didn't have the electrical capacity, the electrical output, to support all those kinds of high-energy products. And that's one of the reasons why people experience so much frustration today. You can't even get the traffic lights to work in some of these major cities because of the electrical outages. And so then you've got huge traffic jams and many, many, many more cars than Iraq had before, because there were, you know, big trailer trucks pulling in hundreds and hundreds of cars. There's now, those cars have broken down and there aren't service stations to do anything to supply spare parts. And so people feel frustrated and angered and wonder why didn't their lives become better when they thought that the United States was going to come in and remove Saddam Hussein. I feel sure that many people in the south of Iraq thought, okay, this is it. This is our moment. Now we won't have to worry about living under a repressive dictatorship. But that moment has not arrived at which they could say that their children are going to experience a better future.
And yet today, there's a report that President Bush has said he's going to keep on considering preemptive warfare an option, speaking specifically about Iran. And he's made statements in the last few days that things are actually going, you know, well in Iraq, or that things are going better than our quote-unquote liberal media makes it sound. I'm wondering, in terms of campaigns or different ideas for action, what Voices for Creative Nonviolence is suggesting at this point, and also what your plans are.
Well, the Voices for Creative Nonviolence campaign that we called Winter of Our Discontent is still going on in Washington, D.C. In fact, I think several of our people are walking into Senator Hillary Clinton's office as we speak. And we think it's very, very important to keep a vigilant lobbying campaign going all across the United States and to follow the lead of our folks in Washington, D.C. They launched a 34-day liquids-only fast, and two people have been taking water only, Jeff Lays and Mike Ferner. And then they're joined by Ed Canan, Lori Blanding right now, Cynthia Banas. And these folks, taking liquids only, have every day been vigiling outside the Capitol building, going inside of elected representatives' offices, creating literature for other people to use. Yesterday they were inside of Hastert's office, and interestingly enough, with a companion week-long vigil here in Chicago outside of Dennis Hastert's office, the aides inside Hastert's office decided that even though our folks were reading the names of people killed in Iraq, both Iraqi and U.S. names, they wouldn't file a complaint. They didn't want an arrest, and I think that was because of so much unrest in the provinces, in a sense, out here. And then next week, we'll be out vigiling in front of Rahm Emanuel's office for an entire week. So I think it's important to communicate we won't go away, that these campaigns are here to stay, that we have to put these elected officials on notice that we want to see the troops come home, close the major military bases, pay reparation for suffering caused, and be all about the work of canceling any debts that wealthy creditors think that Iraq's people owe them because they were foolish and unethical enough to sell weapons to Saddam Hussein in the first place. So all of this campaign work is crucial. It's very, very important. And we know that throughout the United States, and I think in many parts of the world, there will be many vigils and actions happening March 18th as people remark the third anniversary since this immoral, unethical war-making began. We also are ourselves so appreciative of the work that the Christian Peacemaker team has done by remaining in Iraq outside the Green Zone and trying very hard to communicate on behalf of ordinary people in Iraq, taking the same risks that a mortar would hit their house or that one of their number would be abducted and killed, as has happened, taking the same risk that they won't be able to get adequate supplies of food or clean water, as has happened, taking the same risk of just the everyday anxiety about knowing whether or not everybody's, you know, returned back home day after day after day, and then the shortages of electricity. Also trying to report as best as possible about conditions of people who've been detained, who've been held, and many times their families don't know where they are. And these Christian Peacemaker team people have been able sometimes to get the lists and get them translated and get them circulated, and also to try to help host gatherings where people from different walks of life might come together. Well, Kathy Breen is in Amman right now, and I'll join her, and being part both of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, but also going through the Christian Peacemaker team 1 month training, are ready to go over to Baghdad as soon as visas are available. So I plan to live there through April and May. And of course, the CPT presence will remain in the country waiting for word of the three that have been abducted and hopefully will be released. We don't have a crystal ball. We don't know what's going to happen. But in answer to the question of what I would be doing, that's my plan. We certainly read with great concern all of the reports that suggest that there could be an attack against Iran. The New York Times 2 weeks ago said maybe within 108 days, within 6 months. It's very, very hard to know, would this actually take place, or are these trial balloons? But we want to stand firm in opposition to nuclear technology anywhere in the world, in Israel where they have 200 to 400 thermonuclear weapons, opposition to nuclear weapons. Here in this country where we have such obscene levels of nuclear technology and are starting to militarize outer space, certainly we want to say there should not be nuclear weapons, that the planet can't afford nuclear technology. We hope that Iranian people won't go further along that path. But certainly for the United States to resolve disputes by exploiting them with the opportunity of using superior firepower to bomb other people's cities and towns, we think would be creative of just a nightmare, as we would further jeopardize the security of people all throughout the world. So we firmly oppose any United States attacks against Iran.
Well, I want to step back for a second. You mentioned that you're going to be going to Amman and then hopefully on to Baghdad to work with Christian Peacemaker teams. And, of course, it was fairly well publicized. As you mentioned before, Tom Fox, one of the captives who was kidnapped on November 26, 2005, and who was recently found dead. And probably there are some listeners who are going to feel as though, you know, why, given that and given the assumption that, you know, this was some sort of ruthless band of terrorists who didn't care what Tom Fox stood for or what he was there for, why would anybody want to go and do what it sounds like you're going to be doing? What would your response be to that question?
Well, I think that it would be great for people to take a chance to spend time with Tom Fox's diary writings at www.electronicirock.net. Our friend Jeff Gunsel has done a fine job of kind of stitching together excerpts from Tom's considerable diaries. And what struck me so much in reading Tom's writing was that he was quite aware of Margaret Hassan's death, and she was killed when she had been abducted, and it was a terrible death. It was a gruesome reality. Tom Fox understood the risk that he was taking, but what he particularly appreciated about Margaret Hassan was that she didn't choose to live behind gates, that she chose to live in proximity to inside a neighborhood with Iraqi people who couldn't protect themselves from the effects and consequences of war and occupation. And Tom felt that she had lived a life extravagantly on behalf of Iraqi people, and he was drawn to that. Now, it isn't the case that the Christian Peacemaker team people sit inside an apartment all day long and hope that they won't get abducted or bombed. They're out and about meeting with their neighbors, going over to visit places that have been bombed, still trying to work on behalf of people who are under detention and their relatives don't even know where they are. And sometimes the CPT has, to an extraordinary extent, been able to get lists of people under detention and get them translated into Arabic and circulated around mosques and universities. They've hosted still, this past week, gatherings of people from different walks of life who say, we need a place where we can come and sit down and talk to each other. Now, would it be appropriate, because of repression and threat and force and trauma and grief, for the peacemakers to say, well, we're going to clear on out of here. This is over the top in terms of danger, and go back to a country where people are turning over a third of their income? I send 18-year-olds who know almost nothing, in many cases, about what's happening in Iraq, but are told, okay, you go over there and risk your life, come back perhaps maimed or killed or full of post-traumatic stress disorder. You go over there because the United States doesn't want to experiment with unarmed, principled, means of getting to know other people's cultures and trying to treat them fairly. So yes, Tom Fox took a big gamble by going with an unarmed presence to live inside of Baghdad and to write the writings that we now can really learn a lot from. But I think it's a worthwhile gamble. I would feel very, very sad if the Christian Peacemaker Team presence, this sturdy and durable presence outside the Green Zone, inside Baghdad, were to be closed down. So I think it will be a privilege to join it.
For people here in the States, as you mentioned earlier, there's the third anniversary statewide events that are happening across the country. There's a large demonstration planned for April 29th in New York City. What other kind of things might you suggest that people do for those who want to see the U.S. occupation of Iraq come to an end?
Well, I think it would be very appropriate if elected officials were being contacted by their aides in offices all across the country, and the aides were saying, what are we supposed to do with these people? They won't go away. I think people would do well to go and visit their elected representatives' offices and not even necessarily engage in civil disobedience. Just keep on going back day after day after day to make their presence known, to make their concerns known. I think the vigils that have been happening are great, but let's start taking those vigils inside the elected representatives' offices. Be on the phones, write the letters, keep contacting the media. These are the kinds of things that sometimes people can feel so exasperated with, as they might feel like, well, you know, who are we up against these major weapon companies or other lobbies that have so much influence and money? Well, who are we? The New York Times said it, the world's only other superpower. Public opinion, but that public opinion must be made known to elected representatives who are facing campaign seasons, facing elections. So I really think that's very, very, very important. I think it's also important to try to remain educated about the issues and to hold outreach and education events, to keep reading independent news sources, but not to be intimidated into thinking, well, I don't know enough about these issues, so how can I speak up? But I think we do know. We do know that in many ways the comfort of our own lifestyle has been held up to us as a reason not to be willing to negotiate about how much the United States controls the pricing and the sale of other people's precious and irreplaceable resources. So I think another important thing to do is to experiment with simplifying our own lifestyles. That's, again, I point to these young people who have done a 34-day electricity fast and nearing completion of it, and I'm so impressed by that. I mean, as long as I was with a group of kindergartners yesterday. It was very dear of their teacher to invite me to come in. And I thought, well, I'm not sure kindergartners will understand this, but they got it. I asked them to compare the prices, the amount of money their parents would pay for a bottle of soda pop, you know, goes into that, sugar and carbonation, and what you'd pay for an equivalent-sized container of oil that makes the cars go, and what goes into that? Well, you know, 4 billion years of history to build up those precious and irreplaceable fuels. We ought to be wondering, how come we pay the same amount for that we'd be paying for a bottle of sugar and water and fizzies? It's, you know, it's, I think, clear that we've been able to manipulate the control and the pricing of other people's resources in a way that gives rise to them saying, look, this isn't fair. And I think people, you know, would certainly want to sell us their products, but they don't want any longer to live under occupation. They don't want military bases on their soil. And they don't want to feel like they'll be burying their children in constant streams of grief and suffering. Well, these are real grievances. Instead of the United States launching the global war on terror and pouring our resources into building up weapons, why not ask, what are the grievances of people who don't want us in their land?
Well, Kathy Kelly, thank you so much for spending some time with us today, and we wish you safe travels, and thank you for being a voice of peace for all of us.
Well, it's a privilege, Tom, to be with you, and I hope that people in New Hampshire will know how much we appreciate the pivotal role that they'll be playing as election seasons come near. And if anybody would like to visit our website and be in touch with the final days of the Winter of Our Discontent campaign. That's www.vcnv.org. That's www.vcnv.org. And I'll hope if I am able to go to Baghdad to send some written reports and maybe be on your show with you again in the future.
That would be great. We would very much appreciate that. Thanks a lot, Kathy.
Bye-bye now.
All right. For Joe Public Media, I'm Tom Jackson. Thanks to Stanley Longstaff for sound engineering. And you are listening to WSCA LP 106.1 FM